For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
So, welcome everyone. Some of you were here this morning, some of you weren't. For those of you who are new here, I'm Taigen Layton, the teacher here at Ancient Dragons Zengate, and we're very happy to have Florence Kaplow with us this afternoon. She's the editor of this wonderful book, The Hidden Lamp, Stories from 25 Centuries of Awakened Women, and to me, what's really cool is that there are also reflections, by modern women teachers that really reveal how many wonderful women teachers there are, Buddhist teachers and practitioners in the world today. I introduced Florence this morning, but I'll say a little bit. We're old friends, and we've practiced together, and she used to practice in my Sangha in California, Mountain Source Sangha. She's also, as she spoke about this morning, a botanist and environmentalist. And she was ordained by Norman Fisher, who was here last year speaking. And this book is just a wonderful compendium of women teachers and women in Buddhism. And so what we're going to do this afternoon is something much more informal than what we did this morning, which was a Dharma talk, and just to talk about, Florence will talk about the book and where it came from and how it relates to women's issues. And so however you want to do this, Florence, please.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
And as I said this morning, I'm very grateful to Taigen both for our long friendship and shared passion around Buddhism and environmentalism. And for inviting me here. My co-editor and I have been going around the country, but generally what we've been doing is going, there are 100 contributors. So 100 Buddhist women each wrote a commentary on one of the 100 stories and koans. So it's 100 women from 13 different countries, and we said, we're happy to come anywhere and teach with you from this book. And so that's what we've mostly been doing, is going around to places where there are contributors. And this was really a delight that Taigen is enough of a fan of this book to ask that one or both of us come here and share with the Sangha. So I'm very grateful to him, and I really feel like it's incredibly important to honor men who are supportive of women and understand the importance of bringing forward women's wisdom. There's a whole slew of, actually it's not a slew, it's a small number of men in the history of Buddhism, starting with Ananda, Buddha's disciple and cousin, who have done this for us. And we really need to bow deeply to men who appreciate this. And Taigen is in that tradition by inviting the hidden lamp into this community. So really want to thank him for that. So actually what I was imagining, how many people were here for the talk? Just to get a sense of so like about half. Okay, great. And this will be very different. And what I'd really love to do is rather than listening to me go on and on for 15 or 20 minutes before you get a chance to ask questions, as I'm speaking, and we'll allow that time as well and discussion, but if a question comes up for you or a comment, please just raise your hand and we can just let this unfold as a mutual exploration. So you don't need to be kind of holding on to whatever it is that is sparked by something I say until the end. Also, if you have trouble hearing me or anyone else, you know, well, let's see, we could use a different signal. How about like this? So
And just to add, in terms of the format, if someone wants to get up and sit in a chair, or if someone wants to go use the restroom in the middle of this, let's make this very informal. So just feel free to stand up or move around or whatever. This is not a formal Zen event.
Calisthenics, yoga, whatever you feel like you need to do. It's fine. So several people asked, how did this book... What inspired you to do this? How come this book is in existence? And some of us had lunch together, and I was asked, well, you know, do you have a history of being involved with women's issues or feminism? And I brought up my mother because I was raised by a really strong feminist who's now 85 years old. And in Japan, probably as of just about now, she's landing in Tokyo. She is quite a woman. She's also a great adventurer. And her work, she is an art historian, and her specialty was Renaissance art. And starting in the early 70s, she was one of the people who was interested in uncovering and sharing the history of women artists, which is similar in many ways. This is also something that has been largely hidden. So most of us wouldn't have even known, apparently right now at the Chicago Art Institute, who was talking about that?
Yeah.
Yes, there's a...
I don't remember if it's still there now, but it was recently, yeah.
There's a painting by a Renaissance woman. And really, even art historians didn't know very much about women artists until the 70s, when a lot of women scholars started doing the research to discover that. And it's very similar in Buddhism. Maybe especially Buddhism in the West. It's not clear to me how much in Asia there may have been more general knowledge, but definitely in the first wave of Buddhism in the West, most of what we got were male teachers from Asia and male stories from Asia. And I don't think that there was even a whole lot of awareness around were there women Zen teachers in Asia? Were there stories about women in Asia? And I began my own Buddhist practice in the early to mid-80s. And I definitely didn't have any exposure, even as a person who was quite aware of these issues. Early on, when we first started to do some workshops around this book, we were at San Francisco Zen Center, and a woman who started her practice in the mid-1960s as a Zen student said that it was 1986 when she first saw a woman in the teaching seat. So she spent 20 years never seeing a woman as a teacher. And this is actually quite serious, if you think about it, because it's our human way, I think, to, how would I put this, that we need to see people like us on a path that we're on to really believe in our own capacity for that path, right? This is one of the reasons that it was so important that there started to be women professors or women doctors, so that young women could believe that it was possible for them. And, you know, this goes beyond women. This goes for gay and lesbian people, for transgender people, for people of color. You've got to have the examples, the models. Whatever your own path is, you need that in order to nurture your own belief in your own capacity. And there's actually an interesting, let's see if I can find this here, a Dharma sister of mine, Chris Fortin, wrote a one of the reflections in the book, and she had done this very kind of wild thing. So she wrote about a koan where a woman actually gets naked in order to make a point. And we acted this koan out in a women's retreat, and she wore a body stocking. So she kind of had the experience, or close to the experience, of being this woman, this powerful Zen woman, naked. And she talks about, and I just thought this was really fascinating, Chris started practicing in the, I would say, mid-70s. And so she had a long time of, you know, a fairly male-oriented practice. And she says this really interesting thing. She said, prior to entering, so the name of the teacher was Miao Tsong. Prior to entering Miao Tsong's skin, I had never before been consciously aware of how some part of me was subtly and perpetually changing from a woman's body into a man's body in order to fully engage with the teachings. Now, that's a pretty amazing thing to say. Here's a woman who's also a very strong feminist, who's been practicing Zen. See, this would have been written a couple of years ago. So she's been practicing Zen for about 40 years. And she realized for the first time that she was kind of making herself into a man to do the practice. And she goes on to say that Miao Tsong's unbounded confidence in the pure Dharma body of practice and her embodied faith in the sacredness of a woman's body resonated through me like a dragon's roar. So that's sort of a rather long-winded way to try to capture a little bit of my own wish for having access to the teachings of women. The first opportunity I had personally to hear the teachings of women, and there are a few, I mean, I shouldn't say that there are none. In the great koan collections from China, there might be one story about a woman in a collection of 100 koans. So we have had a few of them, and my co-editor tells a really great story from the mid-70s. She was practicing at Berkeley Zen Center, and she really wanted to sit sesshin. She wanted to sit a retreat, and Berkeley wasn't doing that yet. So she went down to Zen Center of Los Angeles, where Maizumi Roshi was teaching. And Maizumi Roshi gave a Dharma talk on a wonderful Chinese Zen master whose name was Iron Grindstone Lu. And Iron Grindstone Lu, there was a reason why she was called Iron Grindstone. She was tough and strong and fearless. And Sue had never heard of her and had no idea that there had been women Zen masters, and it hit her like a bolt of lightning. And she was sitting her very first sesshin, and it was very challenging. And she describes how she would sit there and she'd just say to herself, as she was trying not to think about her knees and how long she was sitting, and she would say, Iron Grindstone Lu, Iron Grindstone Lu. And it gave her the courage to make it. She might not even be a Zen practitioner. She might have run out of that sesshin if she hadn't had Iron Grindstone Lu to give her the strength and courage to sit. For me, my first encounter really with women's teachings and stories was in about 1998. So that I had been practicing at that point for 99, about 15 years before there was this possibility. And there's a wonderful woman Zen teacher whose name is Joan Sutherland, and she is one of the contributors to the book. And she was collecting these stories. She's a translator. She can translate from Chinese, and she was finding and collecting these stories. And she had a little class at San Francisco Zen Center, not a formal class. It was kind of like you had to kind of know that it was happening. And even though I think it was open to anyone, just women came. It was usually just maybe 5 or 6 of us. And she'd bring some of these stories. And it was very significant for me, partly because of hearing these stories, but also there was a subtle difference in the kinds of teachings that were in the stories. And the one that really made a huge impact on me, and remember, you can raise a question, you know, raise your hand anytime. or I'll just keep going. The one that made a huge impact on me is in the book, and it was the one that Sue chose to write about, and it's called Satujo Weeps. And it's about a grandmother whose granddaughter has died. And she was a student of Hakuin, who's a great Zen master of Japan. When she was a young woman, she was considered enlightened, and she was crying at her granddaughter's, at the kind of in front of an altar, I think, you know, after her granddaughter died, and a neighbor comes in, an old man, and he says, "Why are you crying? You're supposed to be this enlightened person. Why are you wailing like this? You ought to lighten up a bit," he says. And she says, "You bald-headed old fool, my tears and weeping are better for my granddaughter than all the priest's incense, flowers, and lamps." Because, you know, traditionally in Japan, the priest would do offerings at a memorial service for someone who died. And what she said was, "My tears are my offering." And I don't know, hopefully you have been better trained than I was, but I think I kind of had an idea, a little bit of an idea, that somehow that enlightened person, kind of like the old man, I had this idea, would not necessarily weep. They'd be somehow free of attachment. And so this teaching of this grandmother who weeps for her granddaughter, who is an enlightened woman, that where emotion is not rejected, it is in fact honored as part of the way, as an expression of the way, was really important to me personally. So then I waited for Joan Sutherland to write the book that was going to be this collection of stories about women. And I waited and I waited and I waited. And some other books came out. There's some great books. There's Grace Shearson's Zen Women, which gathered biographical information about a lot of women. We started to chant the names of women ancestors, which was, that was a very big deal and somewhat controversial in some places when we started doing that. And Norman was very involved with that at San Francisco Zen Center. So there was a growing feeling that, yes, we needed to pay attention to these things, but I still wanted the koans. So about 4.5 years ago, Norman, who is another man who has done a lot to really support women's practice, we have a weekly seminar, and each month there's a different theme, and we did a month on women in Buddhism, which has happened before in the seminar. But that particular one was very contentious, and there was a lot of kind of negative feeling around, and men kind of uncomfortable with it, and it was very kind of complicated. And in that, once again, I kind of had this feeling of, I want to know these stories. I know there has to be more than the half dozen that I know. I know there has to be. I want more stories like that Satsujo Weep story. And so I started looking for them. And I found 10, then I found 20, then I found a whole website done by a man that had 50 koans from China about women on them. And all of a sudden, I had a whole bunch of stories. And it seemed like it wasn't fair to keep these to myself. I mean, this has been kind of my own private project. But I also didn't really feel fully qualified to do this. I mean, I don't know what I thought would be my qualifications, but that I should be a translator. Although, unfortunately, I would have had to be a translator of Chinese, Japanese, Pali, Sanskrit, Vietnamese, Korean, you know. But still, you know, you can always say something to yourself about why you're not qualified to do something. I should be a higher-ranked Zen teacher. I should be a Rinzai Zen practitioner who actually does koan practice in the formal way. I mean, all kinds of things. But I just felt like, well, here I am. And I may not be that impressive, but it's in my lap. Here it is. And I got in touch with Joan Sutherland, and she said, she has a lot of health problems, and she had moved on to doing other things, and she didn't have the energy for this. So then I asked my wonderful friend Sue Moon, who is a fabulous writer and a humorist, And if you haven't read The Life and Letters of Tofu Roshi, I highly recommend it. It is actually a cult classic. And do you have it in the library?
We should. I'm not certain.
Yeah, yeah. So this was an advice column that she wrote for the Buddhist Peace Fellowship journal for a long time, where she was a fictitious character called Tofu Roshi. And she would write the questions and the answers. And they are completely hilarious. I mean, just fabulous. Remember, there was one about a woman's writing in, and she's a housewife, and she says something like, you know, I used to have my meditations were really useful. I could make all the lists of what I needed to do every day, get my whole day organized. It was really great. And now, like, I sit down and my mind is a blank and nothing's happening. What am I doing wrong? So that's an example. So I knew Sue would be really fun to work with, and that she was a very hard worker. She's also an extraordinary activist and just a really delightful human being. So I asked her if she would do this project with me, and she said yes. And then we came up with this really crazy idea that not only were we going to have 100 koans and stories, but we were going to have 100 different teachers. And, it's a good thing that Tigan's leaving right now, because I'm going to say something pejorative about Zen teachers. Trying to get Zen teachers to do something is a little bit like herding cats. He's shaking his head. He's agreeing. Yeah. They're the busiest people on the planet. It's kind of ironic. You wouldn't think that somebody who's dedicated to teaching meditation would be busy, but Zen teachers are very busy. And they're also highly independent people. So I wasn't sure how it was really going to go to try to get 100 women, 100 of the most significant women teachers to contribute. But they did. And one of the things we wanted were stories and teachers from many, many different Buddhist traditions. So not just Zen, but from stories from the time of the Buddha, teachers from the Tibetan tradition, teachers who were women of color, just a really wide view. Because, again, I feel so strongly that we need to open this thing up. We don't need to close it down, and so that the path only looks one way. We contacted. Actually, the first press we contacted was Shambhala, and they've published many of Sue's books. And Shambhala said, "Well, here's the truth of the matter: books about women in Buddhism don't sell well, and we're a for-profit press." And we can't risk it. Which was a little hard to hear, but I knew it was true. I knew that other books hadn't sold well. So then we went to Wisdom, which is a nonprofit press, and Wisdom said this beautiful thing, a little cynical, but beautiful. They said, well, books about women in Buddhism haven't sold well, and this one probably won't either, but this is important, and so we're going to publish it. Now, don't you wish the whole world worked that way? Isn't that great? Isn't that just beautiful? And I think we can kind of thank the Dalai Lama for this, because for a long time, Wisdom was one of the main publishers of the Dalai Lama's books, and I think his books actually still make it possible for them to do something like this. So that's great. So we can bow to the Dalai Lama for his support. So that's a little bit about how the book came into existence. Yes, please.
Could you comment on why books about women in Buddhism don't sell?
Well, I don't know. What do you think? Any thoughts?
It goes back to what you were talking about having examples of proficient people, people in leadership, people practicing something, people exploring something. Most of our examples are male. And I think that even as women, we are not us necessarily in this room, but women in general subconsciously don't look at another woman as being an authority. Mm-hmm. I was raised Catholic, so I found that own bias in me that And I'm not saying I'm there now at this point in my life, but maybe in my late 20s, early 30s, I would dismiss, like, spiritual work. If a woman was speaking about spirituality, I immediately dismissed.
Mm-hmm.
And I found myself doing that in my, basically when I started Buddhist practice, because you're starting to realize how you think about things. And I didn't realize I was doing that.
Hmm.
But I automatically kind of shut down. Oh, she doesn't know what she's talking about. She's not a priest, you know, a male priest. And that was just the conditioning I had from my childhood. So I'm sure that partially has something to do with why books about women don't do well.
And, you know, there's another, there might be another factor. I think that is actually part of it. I think it's a really insightful view. And another thing, and I think we're moving beyond this, but it's not uncommon. It was not uncommon in some Buddhist realms for a teacher to say, and on one level, this is true. In our basic nature, we are not male or female. The Buddhist path is not concerned with male or female. We are far beyond any definition of that kind. And so this talk about women and men just breeds dualistic thinking. And we are a non-dual practice. So that belief is still out there. Like the feeling that, well, if you go and read about women, you're sort of creating a dualism. And a friend of mine who's a Vipassana teacher that I've done a fair amount of teaching of these stories with, this is something she had to really look at when we started doing this, because she said, I kind of feel this way that I'm not really supposed to be focusing on women because it's dualistic. And then what she realized and was able to teach and speak about was that, you know, in Zen particularly, we really talk about the relative and the absolute, right? So the absolute view is that we are beyond male and female. Our basic nature is beyond male and female. In the relative world, male and female matters a lot. We were talking about why is it that the books about women in Buddhism haven't sold well?
Oh.
So we're sort of exploring what that might be. And so... So we, you know, the world we live in, what I often say is, what is the first thing you notice about another person? The very first thing. And if you don't think it's gender, try meeting a genderqueer person where you can't quite tell. Notice how it makes you feel. Hopefully this is fairly widely known. Transgender people are murdered at a much, much higher rate than any other population. And it's because, I believe, we are deeply uncomfortable with not being sure of the gender of, and we is maybe not the right word. Some of us, I mean, I'm feel really passionately, actually, about the importance of a transgender perspective in the world. I really appreciate that there are people who have the courage to express themselves in that way. But this is what we do. Are you male or female? What's the first box you check on any? So in the relative world, we are completely shaped by gender from the time we're born. And so so teachings about women do matter in all the ways that we were talking about, the ways that you, as a woman, might not fully feel kind of the authorization or capacity to awaken. It's very common still in Asia. There's a common belief that enlightenment is only possible in a male body, and women pray to be reborn as a man. And if you think about this, it makes a little sense, right? Because women have, you know, especially in traditional cultures, have so few opportunities to practice in the way that men can practice. So, of course, I mean, if somebody said to me, because you're female, you need to stay home and take care of your parents and children and husband, and you are not going to be able to do the kind of practice that a man could do, I'd probably be praying to be reborn as a man, too, honestly. So, but this idea is, although we, I think most of us, do not walk around with that sense of things, it's kind of in the DNA of our, yes.
This is so much part of our culture now, too, with politicians, you know, out loud saying that women should not, that it's ridiculous that women should expect to get the same pay for the same job.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there,
mm-hmm.
there are Congress people saying that now.
Just,
I'm sorry, as a man, I'm offended.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of us women were saying it too.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Right. Yeah. And for it, oh, please.
I don't think we should apologize for the next 1,000 years of an essentially affirmative action
yeah.
for gender equality.
Yeah.
And as you say, transgender and non-dualistic gender equality.
Yeah.
But I think we're in that millennium, but it's going to be a long time. But yeah. I don't think we should. Should question that it's
yes, I think you're right. You know, and just to give you a sense of how much this is a still alive in Asia, we really wanted to find a Korean. It's very common. We knew we needed contributors who had some knowledge of written English because the translation would be too hard. But we knew that there are a lot of Koreans actually, you know, grow up learning quite a bit of English, educated Koreans. And so I thought, oh, it'd be so great to have a contemporary Korean woman teacher. So I started putting out the word to people I know who are in the Korean Buddhist community. Nothing. Everywhere I went, I could not find the name of a Korean woman teacher who might be available. And finally, a woman who is an American nun, she's practicing in Korea, wrote, and she said, okay, I'm just going to tell you how it is. Here's the reality. In Korea, it is considered a sign of a woman's attainment that she is silent about the teachings.
Mm-hmm.
So if she speaks about the teachings, it means she must be less attained. And women maintain this. I mean, it's not just men that are enforcing this, but nuns will say, oh, yeah, you know, she shouldn't be speaking. You know, she has this level of attainment. And the one woman just died who was a Korean teacher. I did contact her, but she doesn't do kind of commentaries on koans, or she didn't, is a woman who self-ordained outside of the traditional schools and self-acknowledged herself as a teacher. And she had thousands of students in Korea. And she could speak. So I think to say that gender doesn't matter is in fact a misunderstanding of the teachings of the relative and the absolute, and a misunderstanding of, if it didn't matter, then we would have as many women around the world teaching as we do men. And we also have to acknowledge that there are hundreds and hundreds of women teachers now. And, you know, think about that woman who said she hadn't seen a woman in the teaching seat until 1986. From 1986 to now, it's just an extraordinary shift worldwide. Maybe not so much in Asia, but it's happening in Asia too. Please.
Similar, but maybe a little different angle of thought that I was having about this question about why these books that are specifically saying that they're somehow about women and gender and Buddhism, one of them saw, was thinking about why people turn toward a Buddhist book. You know, what are they seeking? What are we seeking? That we're seeking the spiritual, you know, or something in our lives that's missing, and that there's a sense that politics or social issues aren't as deep, or they're not going to give us what we want. You know, so I think people will buy like a Pema Chodron book. There are women teachers who are very obviously popular, and I assume her books sell in that.
Extremely well.
Right.
Yes. There's a reason why she's on the cover of every other Shambhala Sun.
Yeah. So, you know, but that's because she's selling, I don't mean in the pejorative way,
right.
What's being offered there is teachings.
Right.
You know, and I feel like that's with this book too.
Right.
It's teachings.
Right.
But if you want to go and think about political issues, it kind of feels like, ah, oh, that's not what I'm.
Yes.
So it's hard to blend the two
mm-hmm.
of your real spiritual path of, you know, I want to go down to the core. And get help for myself, and
yeah.
along the way, I'm gonna sort out some of these political queries, conflicts, and it's not so inspiring all the time.
It's true. It's a good point. And I mean, although I will say, I think that one of the most important things we can do in our practice is look at our conditioning, right? Yes. And develop some degree of freedom within and beyond our conditioning. And if we're not willing to look at our gender conditioning, we're missing a big piece. And I think this is true for men as well as women. I will say, I this is bragging, but forgive me. This book... it came out about the beginning of November. By mid-December, it had sold out its first printing, which was 4,000 copies. And it's still selling extremely well. So this is meeting a need. And that's really wonderful. And I really, you know, it's wonderful because Wisdom also did take this risk and this chance with the book. And, Yes.
Just a comment on this is that also, it was interesting, when I started reading this, I realized that I related to this. You know, so this issue of male-female, you know, when I began reading, I don't think I expected to feel a sense of familial or like something that is, I get this. It's like, I feel like somebody's speaking to me directly and I can access it in a mm-hmm. different way than I can... a lot of text, you know, the other text I'm having to work at and try to read between the lines and figure out. This one, I mean, it's like, and so it stood out to me, is that the difference of men and women, or is there something about the way I think that is very similar to the way other women think, or I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But it did make me think that because it really resonates. It's very easy for me to take this in.
You know, I think there's another piece which we haven't brought up yet, but which is actually, I think, as important as what we're talking about with gender, which is that the traditional teachings generally came from a really strongly monastic context.
Right.
So they were not only about men, they were about men in monasteries. Okay. And from men in monasteries. And most of us are not, even men, if we're men, are not men in monasteries. And so it's another level of, those amazing great teachers, I could never come close because not only am I not male, but my God, I have, this is not me, but I'm just saying, a person could say, I have four children. How could I ever emulate that person? Well, if you read the stories in this book, you know, some of them quite ancient, they're about people with children. They're about whole families practicing together. They're about women awakening as courtesans. They're about just this huge range of, and what I always, I feel like, you know, one of the big messages that I feel runs through all these stories is awakening is possible in any circumstance. These women faced enormous barriers, barriers we can't even imagine in their lives. Some of them were slaves. Many of them were servants. And within that life, they were able to awaken. So, Can I share a story? This is one of my favorites. There's a story from Japan about a woman named Chiono, who actually was, when her enlightenment was acknowledged, she was the first Japanese woman to be acknowledged as awakened, and she went on to found her own monasteries. And there are many stories about her, and this is just one version of her biography. There are some others. But it's interesting how it brings this up. So she was a servant in a Zen convent. And this is actually an abridged version of a longer story of her life. And she kept going to the nuns and saying, I want to learn how to practice Zazen. And they kept saying, no. Your job is to be a servant. Our job is to practice Zazen. This is an example of how women can do this to each other. And also, by the way, you know, you're not educated. You don't have the capacity. So just, you know, your work is your practice. Go do your work. So finally, she approaches this elderly nun, and she says this thing that's so poignant. "I'm of humble birth. I can't read or write and must work all the time. Is there any possibility that I could attain the way of Buddha, even though I have no skills?" And I don't know, whenever I read this, I feel like this somehow resonates with something in me as well. And the nun does this beautiful response, and this is also kind of abridged. She says, "This is wonderful, my dear. In Buddhism, there are no distinctions between people." This is what she does here is actually a beautiful kind of turning of non-dualism in a helpful way. She says, "There is only this. Each person must hold fast to the desire to awaken and cultivate a heart of great compassion. People are complete as they are. If you don't fall into delusive thoughts, there is no Buddha and no sentient being. There is only one complete nature. If you want to know your true nature, you need to turn towards the source of your delusive thoughts. That is called zazen." And so Chiono says with happiness, "With this practice as my companion, I have only to go about my daily life practicing day and night." So there's no room in her life for sitting down and doing zazen. She's working all the time. But this nun offers her this teaching that right in the middle of her life as a servant, she can practice. And so that's what she does, and she does it wholeheartedly. After months of wholehearted practice, she went out on a full moon night to draw some water from the well. The bottom of her old bucket, held together by bamboo strips, suddenly gave way, and the reflection of the moon vanished with the water. When she saw this, she attained great realization. Her enlightenment poem was this: "With this and that, I tried to keep the bucket together, and then the bottom fell out. Where water does not collect, the moon does not dwell." And it's in the larger version of the story, it said that she immediately went to the old nun and did three prostrations to her, thanking her for her teaching. So to me, this is a story that is truly about our lives. And it's accessible in a different way. And I don't know if you feel that, you know, as you were saying, there's some way that you feel that there's a connection.
Yeah, that story, in fact, stood out to me. I don't know exactly why. It's difficult, but there's a way in which it connects with, it seems relevant.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Trying to hold it together and let go and lose the reflection and be present and be with what is.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that we often say when we're talking about the book is also another way that koans are sometimes understood in Soto Zen is as the family stories. So we chant in some Zen temples, the names of the ancestors are chanted, and over the years, as you're exposed to these ancient stories, it's like you hear the word Jiaozhou and you know the stories about Jiaozhou, just like you might know the stories about your great-grandfather. But for both men and women, we've really only known the story of the male side of our family. And Norman says this great thing that it's as he feels like when he had given during, a ceremony where people take precepts where they're given the lineage, and he's always given the lineage of men, he's had this feeling that it was kind of incomplete. And now he gives the lineage of women too. And he feels like, oh, now it's complete for both men and women. That there's, both of those. But I think there's also this thing around that there have always been powerful, wise women, and there have been powerful, wise, ordinary people who were not the great Zen masters in the monasteries. And in fact, my favorite set of stories from the book are the old women stories, which often involve a Zen master encountering one of these old women, and they are completely meeting as equals. There's no question that there is that the reason these stories were kept is not because of the great wisdom of the Zen master, but because of what they bring up together. Yes.
I'm excited. There are three things I think that I always loved about Zen. One is that it's iconoclastic and American. I think American culture is essentially iconoclastic, so it matched that way. Another was, I think, although we're concentrating on women here, that there are so many of those sorts of stories that let us subtly know as Americans, even though we are not, essentially we had no access to the tradition, even though it was being brought. We knew from the start we're not the right people, we're not from the right place, we're not in the right place, we don't have the culture.
Yeah.
And yet these stories were giving us some hint that it was possible for us to practice, and it was possible for us to take this direction. And I always appreciated that. Another older tradition that I appreciated was the Indian tradition of householders, householder men, at the ends of their lives, after having done normal day-to-day life, then making an advancement in their... Anyway, but the last thing I want to mention is that and it might just be, it's the nature of the Zen, but the existence of these stories hints at a subversive scholarly or subversive spirituality that's always been there. Otherwise, the stories would never have come to us at all.
That's true.
They would never have been used.
Yeah.
And I love that that's there.
Yeah.
it gives us an entree into deeper cultural iconoclasm.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And, you know, we don't know in most cases who wrote these stories down or who collected them. We do know, maybe I have to share the story of Miao Zong just because it's so great. And we actually know who, and I'll ask you at the end to see if you can figure out who might have put this story into writing. Let me share it with you. So this is the one, remember I read the little thing about Chris Fortin and the body stocking? What are we doing on time here? Okay. Mm-hmm. So this is the story that she was commenting on, and it's quite a story. Where is it? Oh, I thought it was right here. If anybody, oh, there it is. Miao Zong's Dharma interview. Okay. Okay, this is one of the racy ones. If you spend a little time with the book, you know that there's actually quite a... And this is another thing we haven't talked about, but there's a lot about sexuality and desire and body that, again, you don't tend to hear so much in the traditional stories. Maybe that's another part of that undercurrent that Kevin was talking about, that this wasn't what made it into canon, but actually people were working with these questions around desire. And, so anyway, this is Miao Zong. Before Miao Zong became a nun, she used to visit Master Dahui Zhonggao's monastery to study with him, and he gave her a room in the abbot's quarters. And the abbot's quarters would have been quite a large part of the monastery, so it's not like he's sleeping with her. She's in an honored part of the monastery. The senior monk, Wanan, did not approve. Dahui said to him, "Although she's a woman, she has outstanding merits." Wanan still disapproved. So Dahui urged him to have an interview with Miao Zong. Wanan reluctantly agreed and requested an interview. Miao Zong said, "Do you want a Dharma interview or a worldly interview? In other words, are you really interested in bringing up the teachings together here, or do you just want to chat?" And of course he says, being the head monk that he is, and by the way, you have a head monk right here. This is an example of the head monk tradition here. Although I'm sure he would never act like Wanan. So Wanan says, "A Dharma interview." Miao Zong said, "Then send your attendants away." She went into the room first, and after a few minutes she called, "Please come in." When Wanan entered, he saw Miao Zong lying naked on her back on the bed. He pointed at her genitals, saying, "What is this place?" I don't know the tone that he used. So now I imagine it was maybe not neutral. Miao Zong replied, and this is one of the great lines in my feeling of everything that women have said. all the Buddhas of the three worlds, the six patriarchs, and all the great monks everywhere come out of this place. And just imagine an American Zen monastery, and the head monk is disapproving of something, and a woman does this. I mean, even now, it would be completely and utterly shocking. And we're talking Confucian China, and a lay woman in a monastery surrounded by hundreds of monks, and she does this thing. I mean, this gives you some sense of her power and courage and determination. So anyway, that's what she says. So Wenan says in reply, "And may I enter?" Yeah, a little shocking. Miao Tsong replied, "Horses may cross, asses may not." And this is a very little clever kind of double entendre going on here, because this is from a very famous koan about Zhaozhou. Yes. That she's about. Can you do it from memory? I'm not sure I could. But it's about the bridge of Zhaozhou, the great stone bridge of Zhaozhou, and a monk kind of coming along saying, "Oh, I heard there was a great stone bridge of Zhaozhou, and all I see is this little wooden thing." And he says, "Horses may cross, asses may not." So
sometimes it's politely translated as donkeys may not.
Is that a reference to purity as well? Purity of intention, purity of practice? Like the purity of a horse versus the mix of donkey?
It's just different, you know, quality of beings.
Yeah. And whether, I would also say, whether you see it as a stone bridge or a wooden bridge has something to do with, you know, what is your capacity of seeing. So that's what Miao Tsong says. Wenan was unable to reply. In other words, at this point, he is completely flummoxed. Miao Tsong declared, "I have met you, senior monk. The interview is over." She turned her back to him. Wenan left ashamed. Later, Da Hui, who's his teacher, said to him, "The old dragon has some wisdom, doesn't she?" So here's the question. Who wrote that down? Does anybody want to hazard a guess? Who made sure that story was passed on?
Well, I have a guess, but I'll let somebody else guess.
Okay.
Well, I hope it's the head monk.
It was. So to me, that says something really wonderful about Zen practice. Here was a man who was just about as completely humiliated as, you know, as not just, but as a Zen person. And he recognizes that he was in the presence of a great teacher. And he wrote of his own humiliation. As in his own record, this is recorded. So I find that very encouraging. Yeah.
So along those lines, would you please tell the story that you told me that came after this about in Japan about the dragon?
Oh, okay. Well, so you're getting actually a special treat here, because this story is not in the book. And I'm very sad about it, because it might be... It's very close to my very favorite story about a woman. This is the one. Yeah, yeah. I forgot that I told you this yesterday.
Yeah, about Kuya, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I was in Japan for the first time this May, and I've been waiting, it feels like, maybe lifetimes to get to Asia. I mean, I've been practicing Buddhism for all this time, and I never have a lot of money, and so getting to Asia was always just out of reach for me. But there was a group of Zen students from Vancouver, British Columbia, who were old friends of mine, who were going on a Zen pilgrimage, and they invited me along. And so I was able to go for the first time. And it was my first day in Japan, in Kyoto. And I have a friend who lived in Kyoto for 40 years, and he had said, "You've got to meet this friend of mine, Barbara," who is another American expatriate in Kyoto. So I got together with Barbara that first day, and we went for a walk, and we walked around this beautiful lake, and she said, "You know, there's a great story about a dragon in this lake, and I can't quite remember it, but when we go back to my house," I'll ask my husband, she's married to a Japanese man, "I'll ask him what the story is." Well, it turns out her house is an ancient temple in the middle of Kyoto, a tiny ancient temple, really not much bigger than this, but beautiful carved roof tiles and carvings everywhere. And her husband is the descendant of a family that has taken care of this temple for probably 800 years. And so he is a Tendai priest, and he takes care of this temple, and it's dedicated to a man who is a monk in the Heian period, which is very, very early in Japan, 9th, 10th century, whose name was Kuya.
I'll just say a little bit about who Kuya was. He was, before there was a formal Pure Land school, he was a Pure Land, he was a Tendai monk, but he would do the Pure Land practice of chanting Namo Amida Butsu, which became, now it's the dominant form of Japanese Buddhism, chanting, of Pure Land Buddhism, chanting to Amida Buddha. And he's famous for walking, going around the streets of Kyoto and dancing and chanting. And he had there's a wonderful statue of him with a staff with an antler at the top, and he's chanting Namo Amida Butsu, and there's a wire coming out of his mouth, and you may have seen pictures of this with little Amida Buddhas coming out of his mouth. But he was before Pure Land Buddhism became a very important separate branch of Buddhism in Dogen's time in 13th century. But anyway, so that's who this guy is.
Yeah, and so he was kind of an ecstatic. He was kind of a mystical ecstatic, and he was also known for his tremendous generosity and kindness. And he's really almost like a saint, really. And Kyoto very much identifies with him. And actually, in this temple, there is I think it's one of the main statue. I think is in the museum, but they actually also have a statue of his it's an old wooden statue.
The main statue is in a temple called Rakuhara Mitsuji, which is where Dogen gave the Zenki.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, a wonderful temple. Anyway.
Yeah. So Barbara's husband speaks English, and she said to him, please tell Florence that story about the dragon. I can't quite remember it. And he said, oh, yes, of course, I'll tell you the story about the dragon. And this is the story. Kuya would go out begging every day. He had these begging rounds, and part of his begging rounds went through the palace grounds. He was actually the son of an emperor, so he had probably some special permissions. And this lake that I had walked around earlier in the day was part of the palace gardens. And he'd go walking around on his begging rounds. He'd go by this lake every day. And there was an old, old, old woman sitting by that lake who was a beggar. So desperately poor, dressed in rags, and she'd be begging at the lake. And every day he would share some of the food that he'd been given on his begging rounds with the woman at the side of the lake. And this went on for a long time. They were good friends. And then one day he walked by the lake and she wasn't there. And the next day he walked by the lake and she wasn't there. And he was tremendously worried about what might have happened to her. And finally, one day he went by the lake and she was there again. And he rushed up to her and he said, how are you? I've been worried about you. Are you all right? And she said, I've been very, very ill. And I'm dying. And he says, what can I do to help you? Can I get you medicine? Can I get you food? Can I get you some warm clothing? And she says, no, it's too late for all those things. I'm dying. But I do have one request. And he says, anything, what can I do to help you? And she says, I would like to spend the night with you. And he says, I can't spend the night with you. I'm a monk. I've taken vows. I'm not allowed to spend the night with a woman. And she says, well, that's my deepest request. Is she all right? Second.
This will make it this hard.
So, So this is her deepest request, and of course he is now faced with a terrible dilemma. And he thinks about it really hard for a while. And then he turns back to her and he says, "All right, I'll spend the night with you." This is a man who is known as this great monk of Kyoto. He is about to lose all of his reputation here. He is going to break his vows in order to spend the night with this old, old, decrepit, dying woman. And she, when he says this, takes her true form, which is the form of the dragon in the lake. So this immense dragon appears before Kuya, and the dragon bows down to him and says, "This was a test, and you passed." So that's the story. And I just love this story because I think it says something about the Mahayana way, which is that we live ethical lives, we live lives of vow, but ultimately, our ultimate vow is a vow of kindness. And the old woman is teaching him something. I mean, he was obviously a little bit attached, naturally, to his monk's way, and she taught him something that took him beyond that way. So that's as I said, I love the old woman's stories, and I think that's one of the truly great ones, but you won't get to read it in the book. You can pass it on orally.
A story like that raises to me the question that, you know, even beyond this, you know, questions of gender and that kind of thing, there's this big issue that I think is particularly important for Zen in the West, or is coming, you know, that we have to deal with in a different kind of way. And this has to do with this kind of conflict throughout the history of Buddhism between this sort of anti-body, anti-sex, anti-material kind of strain, and then this more sort of open, you know, accepting, this is who we are, you know, this is our life, you know. Could you say anything about that?
Well, one of our contributors said this as well as I've ever heard it said, so maybe I'll share a little bit of it. So this is something that Blanche Hartman shared. Oh, nice. And Blanche Hartman, for those of you who don't know, was the first woman abbess of a Western Zen center. She is somewhere over 85. I'm not quite sure where. She chose actually quite a famous...
And she's also formerly one of my teachers. She was the teacher at Tassajara when I was Shuso there.
Yes, and she... She's really quite extraordinary. And she
She was Hogetsu's teacher, as a sewing teacher. So.
She chose the koan called "The Old Woman Burns Down the Hermitage." Oh. And this is actually one of the few koans that if people know stories about women, they'll know this story. And I'll just kind of summarize the story. Basically, an old woman has been sporting a hermit for a long time. She wants to test him, find out what he really understands. He's a monk. And she sends a young girl to embrace him and see what he says, what he does. And so the young girl goes, embraces the monk, and then comes back and reports to the old woman that the monk said, "A withered tree," let's see if I can get this right, "a withered tree on a cold boulder has no warmth in winter." That was his response to the young woman. And the old woman is furious. She says, "I can't believe I've been supporting an imposter for all these years." She grabs a stick, she runs up the hill, she beats the hermit, and she burns his hermitage to the ground. That's the story. Okay? So it's a pretty interesting story. And
that's making his statement true.
That's right. He has no more warmth in winter. She's the, and so Blanche chose this story, this very upright Zen teacher, who is married for 65 years and very, in some ways, you would think... anyway, I'll tell you what she wrote. We did an interview and then transcribed it. "I think that the monk in this koan was totally off base in his attempt to squelch his human feelings, in his efforts to shut down rather than celebrate his human feelings. Ehe Dogen describes enlightened beings as, quote, having few desires, But I don't think that having few desires means suppressing feeling. For me, it means just being aware of all that we have to be grateful for and thereby knowing that we don't need anything more. So it kind of turns this whole idea, you know, kind of gratitude. What about gratitude practice? And she says, through Zen practice, we develop a greater and greater appreciation of everything around us. We don't become an old, withered stump. I'm much more alive than I was when I started this practice. And I love that. I love that a woman who is 85 could say that. I am much more alive than I was when I was 30-something. And much more appreciative. And that's true of most Zen people I know. The practice is not about suppressing desire or destroying our humanity, but about allowing it to flow out to everything rather than to a particular object. I met Zen practice through Suzuki Roshi, Katagiri Roshi, and Sojin Mel Weitzman, who is still the teacher at Berkeley Zen Center. And these were not withered trees. These were very lively people. In every photo I have of Suzuki Roshi, and I have a lot of them, he's laughing or smiling. My teachers and my practice have never taught me not to enjoy life. The deeply seasoned teachers I've had the opportunity to meet have all been supportive to people who are suffering, but they've also been very playful and lighthearted. And it just strikes me, I hear a kind of resonance with what I was talking about this morning, right? Which is about this combination of like being willing to meet the suffering of the world and also to really appreciate the world and its beauty and the people in it. In the case of the monk and the young girl, was she going to be hurt by any show of affection on his part? She was much more likely to have her feelings hurt by rejection. But the monk had used the practice to shut down all feelings so as not to be disturbed by it. That is a misunderstanding of the teaching, which is about the ending of suffering. The monk could have responded to the young woman kindly, saying to her, for instance, so this is Blanche imagining a better response, "You're young and beautiful and very attractive, but I'm a celibate monk, so I'm really sorry I can't accommodate you." Responding in this the way he did, he wasn't being compassionate. And she actually talks about giving hugs to students in the Dokusan room and how she knows this might not be appropriate, but after all, she's old enough to be most people's grandmother. So, and then she ends with this great thing from Brother David Steindl-Rast, who's a Benedictine monk who practiced Zen for many years. And he was giving a talk at Tassajara Zen Monastery, and someone asked him about his vow of celibacy. Brother David said in response, "But if I want to love everyone the same, I have to be either celibate or very promiscuous." And I think that really, that kind of gets, like, that's a very different understanding of, oh, there's something wrong with the body. We have to cut off these human affections and desires. It's more like, no, we actually have to open up so far that we are open to everyone. And it may be, depending on who we are, that the best way we could do that is to be a celibate monk. But that's very different than cutting off or squelching or suppressing our humanity. And she ends with, "I love that image of loving everyone the same. That's something I've taken on myself, to love everyone the same, to love everyone completely. It's not about withering our perception or appreciation of the world. It's about becoming more and more appreciative of the world, its beauty, all it has to offer us, and our total connection with it." And I do think this is something that these koans offer. Is this? There's actually a very powerful koan about a kind of somewhat magical courtesan who teaches a pilgrim about working with desire. She works with desire through her sexuality. That's actually her gift to the world. So there are a lot of ways of turning this. And again, I feel like maybe before we had access to some of these stories, it's kind of extraordinary how little anything about the body or desire comes up in the traditional Zen stories. I mean, it's as if it was a non-issue. And I think it's pretty unlikely that it is a non-issue. So we're really, even though maybe to some degree these stories about women were used to kind of, like that was the place where it was allowed to be explored, still, it's wonderful for us to have access to these teachings. And I can't think of a single one. There are lots of stories about women who are not allowed to join a monastery because they were the teacher thought that their beauty would distract the monks. And there are a number of rather horrifying stories for us as modern people where the woman scars herself in order to enter the monastery, because then her beauty would no longer distract the monks. Yes?
Are there any stories of women who passed as men? You know, there's threads in Western history of women, particularly in conflict, passing as men to enable them to have that kind of...
Not that I know of. Now, in the modern era, we have the example of Alexandra David Neal, who was a kind of British explorer who did pass as a man in Tibet. That was how she traveled around. But I haven't heard any of the stories in here where women were doing that. But what I was going to say is, and this is really wonderful, and if you haven't read this, it's... I think as a woman, I know it was... I had been reading Dogen for many, many, many years before I knew about one of his writings, which is called Raihai Tokutsui, and it is translated as, I think, generally, getting the marrow by doing obeisance, so by bowing. Is there another translation?
Well, literally, it's doing prostrations and attaining marrow.
Okay, so you kind of get the feeling of that, right? In fact, many of the stories in this book came from that Dogen's exploration and celebration of women as teachers. So this is, you know, this is 13th century Japan. And he has this wonderful section in there where he says, why is it that we think, because at this time a lot of what was happening in Japan is that women were being barred from even entering monastic precincts. There were like... Mount Koya, which is a Shingon monastic complex, women were not even allowed inside the whole complex. And there was a women's pilgrimage route around the outside because they weren't even allowed to enter. And Dogen says, this is ridiculous. If we don't allow women to enter monasteries because they're objects of desire, and if we won't look at them because they're objects of desire, and we don't teach them anything because they're objects of desire, what are we going to do about the fact that men can also be objects of desire, and inanimate objects can be objects of desire, and clouds in the sky can be objects of desire? Are we going to get rid of all those things too? And it's like he really got this. He really understood that to reject that the problem with desire did not rest in the object of the desire. The problem rested in the person who's working with their desire. I really bow very deeply to Dogen. And Suzuki Roshi, before he came to America when he was a young man, did his thesis as a student at the university on this writing of Dogen. So I've often wondered if maybe that's part of the reason that he could come to America and appreciate women and women's practice in the way he did. He had really, really studied this topic.
That particular essay, Raihai Tokutsui, I don't know if we have a copy of it in the library, but it's just an incredible... He goes on. It's a very powerful statement of gender equality. It's amazing. It's a very... it's the most powerful statement of anything in Asian Buddhism that I've seen of is how ridiculous it is to be prejudiced against women and against women, against the capacity of women to be enlightened, and goes on.
We broke our own rules in the book because all of the stories in the book are dialogues, except for we had to include something from Dogen because we felt like we had to acknowledge him and let people know about... I'm trying to find it.
You have something from Right Hand Talks?
Yes, we do. We have a section. It's not the one about desire, which is really great, but it's another one. Let's see, 220. Oh, here. We called it Dogen Sets the Record Straight. Master Ehe Dogen said to his monks, "There are foolish monks who make a vow never to look at a woman. Is this vow based on the teachings of the Buddhas, or on the teachings of the non-Buddhists, or on the teachings of Mara, the Lord of Delusion? What are the inherent faults of women, and what are the inherent virtues of men? There are unwholesome men, and there are unwholesome women. Hoping to hear the Dharma and leave the household does not depend on being female or male. Before becoming free from delusion, men and women are equally not free from delusion. At the time of being free from delusion and realizing the truth, there is no difference between men and women. If you vow never to look at a woman, must you then abandon women when you chant, 'Beings are numberless, I vow to save them'? If you do so, you are not a bodhisattva. How can you call it the Buddha's compassion?" So I really recommend this. It's online, too. And you know what it is in? It's in the full set, that double volume of Dogen's writing. You can find this.
It's in one of Francis Cook's early translations, too. It's available.
But you know, most women I know, even people who've been practicing Zen for a long time, are not aware of this writing. And it is really inspiring as a Soto Zen practitioner to realize that the founder of our school in the 13th century, against every possible cultural view of the time, wrote such a thing, said such a thing. So, as Taigen was reminding me, he spoke most of these, and then they were transcribed. So, yeah. Did you have your hand up?
Yes, unrelated question. I was wondering about how you chose the 100 teachers who you chose for their stories.
Uh-huh.
You know, not the reflections, but...
Well, we wanted as wide a range as we could manage. So, and we definitely missed people that should have been in the book. But we wanted women from all Buddhist traditions. We wanted women of color, where we could find them, who were teachers. We wanted women from other countries if we didn't have too much of a translation barrier. As I think I said, we had 13 different countries. We wanted a range of voices because we do a lot of retreats and workshops with these koans. I wanted to mention before we end that there are a lot... anyway, I'll get back to that, but I do want to say something about working with these. But one of the things that we really wanted to communicate in every way through the book is that there is an idea in our Western kind of misunderstanding of koans that there is a right answer to a koan, and that we're just too dumb to figure it out, or not enlightened enough, or something. And what we wanted was to have, this is why we called them reflections, because it's one woman's view. And we wanted that those views to be as broad and as from as many different perspectives as possible. And we also, you may notice if you read them, that there's always something personal in them. There's always a way that it's about that person's life and practice. And one of the things we said to them is, tell us why you chose this particular koan. What was it about this koan? What is it about this koan that really matters to you in your life? And for some women, that was really difficult to do. They did not want to do it. And we're pretty convinced that it's because women are told all the time that they're too emotional, too personal. And that, especially for the first generation of women Buddhist teachers, they kind of had to cut off that part of themselves. So it's like, I don't want to talk about my personal life. That's not Dharma. That's ego. And we really wanted them to, because we knew, we could see it. As soon as somebody put in something that was actually about their life, it's like the thing went into Technicolor. You know, it had been black and white before, and then it was alive. And
what about the actual, like the koans themselves that you chose that are modern?
Right. Yeah. So we wanted to also have stories from the first generation of Buddhist women pioneers. And they needed to be ancestors. And in our Zen way, that means they've passed away. They're no longer alive. So there are a number of those women. And what we did was we went to their students and we said, tell us a story, which is exactly how the original Chinese koan started. Students passed down the great stories of their teachers' encounters with them or with other people. And so we just did the same thing. And so there's a story about Joko Beck in there, told by one of her students. There's a story about Maureen Stewart. There's a story about Darlene Cohen, who is, you know, it's the last story in the book. She's basically Tigan's contemporary at Zen Center, right? You guys probably...
Yeah. And the commentary or reflection is by Leslie James, who's still one of the teachers at Tassajara and was one of my teachers also.
And a very close friend, actually, of Darlene's. So
yes.
That's a very intriguing combination. But we really wanted to have the sense that people to come away with the sense that this isn't something about, like, enlightenment and wisdom and understanding aren't ancient. They're now, and they're for us now. And we actually are the ancestors of people in the future. Buddhism is only kept alive by each generation living it, practicing it, passing it on. And each of us, as a Buddhist practitioner, is involved with that. Someone may be telling a story about this gathering right here in the future. We don't know. So, do I have a little time? Yeah, I have a couple
yes,
minutes.
You do.
I just wanted to say a little bit about how we've been exploring working with koans. So I think this is really, this is another thing that's kind of new in a way. Or there have been a number of people exploring this, and this we're kind of continuing that process. So in the Zen tradition, in fact, in all of Buddhism, stories and parables have always been important. If you read the first sutras of the Buddhist teachings, they are full of stories, absolutely full of stories. But with Zen and the koan tradition, there started to be these really, think of them as distilled down stories that over time were really used as part of practice. So they were not meant to be approached as literature. They were meant to be approached as, here's a moment where something happened, something transformed for one or both people. And if we get close enough to it, we can touch that transformation in ourselves, potentially. And there's various ways that they've been worked with. And one of the interesting things is that traditionally they sort of said, oh, you know, the Rinzai Zen people who do one-on-one interviews on koans in... with a teacher, between a teacher and a student, that's the real way of working with koans. And those Soto people, they don't really do koans. They just sit in meditation, kind of. We don't know what they do, but they're not doing much. And it's become very clear, based on the work of a number of scholars, that Soto Zen has always also had a koan tradition. It just had a different form. And if you read anything by Dogen, it's full of koans. It's all about koans. And he's always kind of unpacking koans and turning them upside down and inside out. But they were as important in the Soto tradition as they were in the Rinzai tradition. But it's only been, I think, really in this kind of late 20th century America that people have started exploring other ways of working with koans. And my first exposure to that was actually through what Joan Sutherland was doing with the women's koans, which is she was bringing a group of people together and bringing koans to us, and we were exploring them together. And my experience was, and I've had this now many, many times over the years of working with groups and koans, is that you bring up wisdom together. Something very different happens when a group of people, and they don't have to be people who know a lot even about Buddhism, when a group of people encounters one of these powerful stories and they explore it together, something that can arise that's bigger than any one person's understanding. And that's been a big part of my exploration over the last 4 years, is finding ways to make that possible. And it's very inspiring, and first of all, to have women from different traditions. I did a retreat in Seattle where there were women from 9 different sanghas, including Tibetan practitioners, Vipassana practitioners, all these different women, some of whom had never encountered a Zen koan before, and whatever ideas they had about Zen koans were mostly very, very negative. Big sticks and teachers and doing it wrong. And it turns out that this is actually available for anyone. There's no one who, a person on their first day, and this happened at Zen Center of Los Angeles, somebody showing up for the very first time at ZCLA came to a koan workshop, and he was able to enter it too. And so we do writing exercises. We do a kind of process of kind of contemplative writing with them. We do group work. We do embodying them through acting them out, like the woman who we haven't done any naked Miao song, but. And I've really come to believe that that the most important thing to understand as you approach the stories in this book is that whatever they evoke in you at the time that you read them and sit with them is, in fact, exactly what needs to happen. They're mirrors of your life. So if you read something and it resonates in you, that's what matters. It doesn't matter what someone else says about it. It doesn't matter if you have a huge misunderstanding of that koan. It doesn't. None of that matters, because that's what they're meant to be for your own life. That's what they're about. And a spirit of curiosity and willingness to look into your reaction to them is actually all that's needed. And this friend from Bellingham, who's a Vipassana teacher and who I taught with for a number of years, wrote a commentary where she said, "I'm most interested in the thing in the story that makes me uncomfortable." Mm-hmm. That's what I have learned. And here's a woman totally outside any kind of traditional koan practice, and she says, "I love koans, because I get really interested in what is it about this that I'm reacting to?" And that's where she goes, is to explore that more deeply. So I really encourage you. I know there's this book group that's been exploring the book. We have a section in the book called Suggestions for Working with the Stories in the Hidden Lamp, or something like that, to really be creative and not feel like these are somehow sacred and you have to treat them with, put on a very special pair of gloves before you open up the book and treat them as wisdom that can't be played with or messed with, or because they're yours.
Yeah. I think sacred means that you play with them a lot.
Yeah, that's beautifully put. Yeah. I don't think you can hurt them. Let's just put it that way. Any responses to that? Or? Yes.
At Unamara, one of the things that I moved farther away from it, but one of the things that drew me back to it was the fact that we do have a class where we just bring things up and engage together. And that this is this kind of group dynamic, and watching that happen, whether it's, it's often like original teachings, and we'll just sit there and read a part and then start talking, and the conversation might actually lead to something that happened with somebody and a coworker, mm-hmm. or a spouse or something, so it's I think it is a very lively way, and we've been moving more into koans lately, so this new kind of interest in Western Buddhism and koans, and it's somehow very liberating, instead of this idea of like, this is my thing that I have to crack mm-hmm. and carry around.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there is in Soto Zen a tradition. I was introduced to this very early in my own practice with Norman Fisher, of the koan that's arising in your own life. We always have koans arising. We always have these deep questions or this thing that is at the edge of our understanding or this dilemma that, you know, if we stay within the realm of what we know, we can't seem to move beyond. And when we do longer retreats with these, that's where we end. So we spend several days learning to feel comfortable and that we have the right to explore these. And then we end with an exploration of the koan that is yours now. And that's really powerful. Yeah. Yes?
You know, I did some koan study in the past at another center, and I always felt kind of cheated by it because it always seemed so, it was in the traditional sort of center, and it always seemed very barren to me. And at one point I said to the teacher that I wanted to go back and do it again. And he kind of looked at me like, why would you want to do that? And I didn't get it until now, but really, somehow I thought there should be more fun. Somehow I thought, I have to do it again because I missed the fun of it.
Yeah.
I didn't actually get that until you were talking about.
That's great.
The way you play with koans.
Yeah. And there's a lot of laughter in these koans.
Yes.
I mean, not all of them, but there's a lot of laughter. And what a shame that we have to kind of go at them with gritted teeth.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, a lot of this, I think, is actually about unlearning some ideas that we have about what these are. Yeah.
Kathy?
I was just thinking, you know, I have enjoyed our discussions when we've met. I've been to two meetings, and they have been relaxed and fun. And what's interesting is that I also, one suggestion you had was the group could write a poem. Not that I'm suggesting that, but that I have a sense of what other, how other people interpreted things or what really stood out to them at the end of the group. You know, like that Jerry is relieved to know that she can say, I don't know. You know, it's like, so I'm learning things about other people and what speaks to them, you know, in a way that I didn't know before.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what you said about your process, the process of working with koans, is exactly what I have tried to do here. And when we have Dharma talks, we always try and allow time for discussion. There's not usually enough time, but like this morning, but but we do have people do add things, and then when we have all day sittings in the afternoon, we have a discussion period over tea, and a lot of times that's very rich, and people bring in all kinds of things. And so I think that's what the koans are about. That's certainly the koan, the Soto tradition of koan practice is to just play with it and turn it, and whatever, as you said, whatever comes up for you is what it's about.
And so, it's really freeing to kind of drop that. What I notice is a lot of times people approach these with like, there's this great feeling of, I'm not getting it. There must be something wrong with me. Rather than, oh, there's just this one phrase. I don't know what this whole thing is about, but it doesn't matter. There's this one phrase that affects me in a certain way. There's a poignancy that I feel when I read it or whatever. And just working with that. So I'm excited about that because I feel like there is this beautiful, beautiful, deep tradition of stories that in some ways we've kind of, not just the women's stories, but because of our ideas about it, we've been kind of cut off from it. And it is actually a big part of our heritage as Buddhist practitioners. So I'm hoping to help people become less afraid of them and more willing to engage. It's a great thing. And with each other, as you said, you know, you see things about each other as well. Well, we must be getting near the end. Is there any other kind of question or comment or story that someone wants to offer?
I have a story that Florence Kaplow came to Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and talked about women teachers and women practitioners and the history of that, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
And